All right, everybody, here we are on a Thursday night once again. This is Free for All, your libertarian talk show hosted by two Johns. I know that sounds a little weird there, Hody, two Johns, as if we're participating in something perhaps unsavory and unseeming for our spouses to be aware of. But yes, I am Big John. This over here is my friend and co-host, Mr. Hody Johns. Hody, how you doing tonight?
Doing good. The Big Johns and the Big John and the Little Johns, I guess.
As there you go. Yes, Magner, 1 minute hype. Thank you, Magner, for being ready to go, even before we were. That's what I call a true fan. Thank you. We always appreciate our fans, and we'll make sure we let them know that we appreciate them, Hody. Hody, tonight, sort of live talk. We decided this week, you know, Hody and I have a little scuffle. I'm like, let's get some guests. And Hody's like, nah, man, I like this one-on-one. We get to bounce around stuff, you know. So we kind of have a gentleman's agreement that will alternate weeks, you know, unless the circumstances call for it. So this is the week where you get me and Hody bouncing around one topic, essentially, or very few topics, Hody, I would say. And this week, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say Hody has outdone himself. Everyone knows Hody loves to read, and unlike myself, where I gave up reading for Lent 40 years ago, and I don't think I picked up a book since, but Hody still is of that age and of that demeanor where he loves to read. He's a nonstop voracious reader, and I saw him during the week. He was percolating, and he's like, John, I got an idea. I want to read the entire Big Beautiful Bill. So I am actually learned and aware when I comment about it. I was like, Hody, you don't want to do that. You want to be just as ignorant as anybody else who talks about that Big Beautiful Bill and save yourself a lot of trouble. But he's too good of a guy. He's too good of a Christian man to allow that sort of deceit to take place and dishonesty in his assessment. So, Hody, before we even start, I congratulate you on going through that mess all over 1,000 pages worth of gobbledygook, so I'm happy and thankful and grateful that you did that, and we'll get right to that. One last little bit of intro before we head into business, and that is you're watching Free For All right here at Grumblings Media. Grumblingsmedia.com is our homepage. Go there and find out about all our great shows, our great lineup of shows, and specifically, you can check us out on X, at Grumblings Media. You can check us out at Facebook Grumblings Media. You can check us out on Rumble Grumblings Media. You get the idea. Wherever you can find content, look for Grumblings Media, one word, and you'll find our really cool content. Okay. Also, for all our friends, all the chats are open. If you leave us a message, we will see it during the show. And as long as you don't use any dirty four-letter words, we will be happy to answer your questions if we can and time permitting. Go ahead, everyone, hit us up in the chat. But before the questions start rolling in, Hody, there's this thing called the One Big Beautiful Bill that President Trump and his advisors are constantly propping up as the one piece of legislation that covers everything. It's going to save us money. It's going to increase productivity. It's going to do all sorts of stuff. It's going to reduce the deficit. It's going to keep out those dirty immigrants. It'll get rid of the dirty immigrants that came into this country. It'll build another wall. It'll make America even bigger than it is, bigger than U.S. Steel, to quote a line from one of my favorite films, Animal House. We're bigger than U.S. Steel now. Okay. So, Hody, you read this behemoth of legislation. Now, let's start off with you. What's your first impression after you got through reading this tremendous piece of legislation, which, as Archie wants to know, did you read it on ancient papyrus scrolls?
Yeah, I might as well have. One of the issues when you read these bills, and maybe to further toot my own horn, since we're doing that a lot right now, I not only read this bill, but whenever something comes up that says, oh, this changes Title 52, Section right. X5 or whatever, I would then have to look up that and read right. that as well. And I did do that also. So I know right. not only the bill, but everything it's referencing there. My general consensus is this. If you have heard something preposterously over the top about the bill, it's probably not true.
Okay.
Like negatively or positively. And then I will say personally, this is a lot more negative than positive. As far as just generals go, a lot more centralization of power into the executive branch, a lot less to the states, specifically local and state rights. Are dialed back in several significant ways. There is, if I'm just saying generals, big military increase, probably the biggest, the most game-changing, landscape-changing thing will be an increase to the size and scope of the military. Right. And ICE is being promoted essentially to another branch of the military, down to, like, recruiting offices, right, like recruiting at your schools right alongside the Army, recruiting, you know, and not just recruitment. They have a whole fleet of forces. They're going to be organizing strike operations. And then I guess if I were to say one other thing to talk about would be Medicaid. It's getting bigger, but it's going to be more difficult to qualify for at the same time. Very anti-immigrant. And if you are at all, if you believe that the government should do anything regarding environmental protection, you will throw up reading. And that's probably the generals that I have. There are a few positives. Tax on tips, no tax on tips is fantastic. And it's actually as good as I thought it might be. I was, you know, because a lot of times they say no tax on tips and there's a bunch of asterisks and things like that. This, I'm proud to say, is actually just no tax on tips. You're not getting an additional tax for overtime hours. So there are some positives out of it too. But in general, as far as libertarians go, total nightmare.
So, this is sort of a free-flowing show because to go through it, you know, clause by clause is just going to take a couple of days, right? Yeah. So let's try to, like, bucket these concerns. And maybe I'll start out from the layman's perspective, maybe even perhaps, dare I say it, at the risk of angering every libertarian, maybe from the layman libertarian perspective, right? And cue all the people who will say I'm not a real libertarian, but which is fair, I guess. Unexpected. So here's the thing. Let's start out with the positive, you know, and to your point, there are a lot of tax cuts in here. And of course, taxation is theft. So to the extent that there are these tax cuts, I understand that some of them are for a fixed period of time, say a year or two, and some are, they're looking to be made more permanent. Do you kind of have that assessment for us? Like when you look at these tax cuts, and of course you have the politicization that says there are tax cuts for the wealthy, the poorest Americans will see a tax increase, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Cut through the smoke and mirrors for us. What's actually happening here?
You bet. I would love to because I think this is something that we have not been using the right language around. There are not actually new tax cuts in this bill. They are the old tax cuts that were set to sunset. They're the initial Trump tax cuts proposed in 2016, I think officially passed in 2017, and they would expire soon. This would make them permanent. So the tax cuts that we've already been doing would just become permanent. The exception is 35% and over, so the 35% and 38% tax brackets would see their taxes go up to the previous amounts. Now here's the thing: the bill in and of itself, usually you don't get explanations within the bill of what it's trying to do. Sometimes it is kind and helps you out, like it'll say for the purposes. In this case, it actually does tell us that because of rampant inflation, more people will be in the 35% and 38% thresholds because money is worth less, so you'll need more of it. So these highest brackets will have more people in them because the money is worth less. And so there will be an increased revenue here. I also do want to say, in defense of Trump, and I'm not going to have a lot of opportunities to do that with this particular topic, revenues did go up after this round of tax increases. Or tax decreases. So as libertarians, this is a general philosophy. I'm sure, Big John, you get this. But just for the audience, When you decrease taxes, sometimes you become more palatable to other businesses, and they want to do business with you more. And the offset of the increased business will actually make it so that you make more money. If you have trouble conceptualizing that in your head, say I want to take 100% of your income, well, you're not going to just, you're just going to not work, right?
Right.
At all.
You choose not to work, right?
You'll collect zero. So there's a limit where what they call the Laffer curve, people debate exactly where it is, but basically above that point, you actually lose money. It's somewhere between 15 and 20%. I'll let everybody argue about that themselves. But essentially what these tax cuts is do solidify us at about that place where it needs to be, where we actually do have an increase of revenue. So I actually do approve of what we're calling tax cuts, but are actually just the continuation of the taxes as they are right now. Listen, Biden could have canceled them and he didn't. I think he was aware that this kind of people need this right now. We're struggling. We don't need tax increases. It's a positive. So that's what I have to say about that.
Right. And so to the extent that there's tax cuts, which as libertarians, let's face it, we applaud every tax cut because at the end of the day, it's theft prevention. So we applaud that no matter how small. What at times we might object to is the uneven application of tax cuts. So it's not that we say, oh, we want to tax the evil rich. Our position might be, yes, tax cuts for everyone, not just bracket ABC. It should be tax cuts for everyone. And to the extent that we could eliminate taxation, so much the better, right? So do you get the sense that these, and I think you may have mentioned it, but just let me get a one-sentence answer from you. Are these equitable tax cuts, meaning that every American will benefit from?
Okay, one sentence. I will do my best.
Sure. Take two if you need it.
I will say yes for 99%. The top 1% will see their taxes go back to what they were before, and there are actually two major loopholes that executives use to avoid taxation that have been removed. So generally speaking, this will reduce most people's taxes. Now, if you've seen any charts that are like, that your tax burden is going to be higher for most people, that actually is true. That because of the extra spending and everything, that things are actually going to be more expensive. And this actually is a negative thing. I think the number is like $51,000-ish. If you make that or less in a year, you will actually receive more of a burden than you will a relief from the tax cuts, but that factors in the spending as well. So if we're just keeping it to tax cuts,
right,
they're good.
And I think that's the next thing people are going to want to know, right? So if we give the Trump administration credit for saying, hey, there's tax cuts in this, and we'll say, you're absolutely right, there are tax cuts in it. For the most part, they seem to be spread across all the brackets. And to the extent that we don't have to worry about them, like saying the no tax on tips, fantastic. No tax, was it for seniors, I think, that particular – or Social Security benefits won't be taxed, I think. Was that in there or was that just a proposal?
So seniors actually are getting like an extra kickback on their – when they don't itemize their taxes, they're getting like an extra $4,000 back to them. And yeah, there's a lot more for seniors when it comes to Medicaid that makes it I guess we're just talking taxes here.
Yeah.
That I think their tax liability is actually going to remain the same as it is right now. I do have a lot to say about Medicaid.
Right.
I'm trying to remember.
That's a separate bucket. Yeah. So we'll leave Medicaid for the other one. Okay. So let's, so on taxes, we think this isn't a bad deal, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now the part that I, from the, Magner, as you said, Big John's not a libertarian before I even open my mouth. Absolutely. I agree. I'm not. But but here's the thing, right?
Brutal.
Where you see most libertarians, and if I can momentarily hawk my other show, Liberty Lens with Mike Termont, when we dig deep into these things, it's always, listen, you could do a lot of things with taxation. So if you're a progressive, if you're a Keynesian and you're saying like, we got to tax the rich more, we got to do this. we've always noted, you could tax everyone at 100% of their income in this country. You would not balance the budget at all, not even come close to it. The key to balancing the budget, to eliminating the debt, to taking away the hidden taxation, which is inflation. And by the way, inflation is oppressive in the sense that it unwittingly targets the lowest income people in this country, in the sense that they are the least able to keep up with inflation, so they suffer the most from it. So while inflation is steady as a rate, because of what it impacts and how it's measured, when you say the inflation rate's going up, the poor feel it the worst, right? Because to give an absurd example, a millionaire doesn't care if the price of eggs doubles. A millionaire doesn't care if gas hits $5 a gallon, right? They will care. That affects the poor more. So the part that, as libertarians, perhaps we need to be more wary of is to say, what's being done about spending here? And I got to tell you, Hody, I have to be wary, because despite what MAGA might be telling you, the president who added the most debt in history in a 4-year term was President Trump in, you know, his first go round in 2016. So the one big, beautiful bill. I've seen a lot of ministers of propaganda for President Trump, whether it's Stephen Miller, whether it's Caroline Levitt, whether it's that idiot Lutnick. Oh, no, no, no. This bill, it actually cuts spending. It cuts spending. Trust us. Less spending. Is that the case, or am I being too hard on the Trump administration?
It is not even close, and the bill itself, in the very last provision, increases the debt limit by $4 trillion just to finance it for this year. So there's no question. It's not a debate. The writers of the bill know that this will increase spending. As Mike Dermott actually commented on my post about this, it doesn't matter how many tax decreases we get. If the spending goes up, it has to get paid for somehow. So we can say no taxes. Great. We can say 0% taxation right now. Sure. And right, you and I would be happy about that. But the issue is if you're not also spending, that just means more people are going to get taxed later to right, pay for what we're spending right now. And this bill, not even close. There are certain spending reductions. And I will say the spending reductions are mostly environmental, that it's like we're not going to spend any more money on Forest Service is heavily reduced. Basically, unobligated funds for anything environment is gone. I mean, right, it's just that's the best, most general way that I can give it right now. That outside of like the employees you're currently paying and the stuff you currently have, anything money that you might do something with, history. So that, sure, right? I mean, the environmentalists will hate it. But, you know, for libertarians, we kind of go, eh, I don't want government dealing with that anyway. We can have that debate. The issue is like, that's like a fraction of a couple, that's like a couple $1 million. And then in the next sentence, it's just like, and then $4 billion for the IRS to do this, and, you know, $50 billion for ICE to do this. And you're just like, okay, so you've already way outspent anything that you might have saved with these cuts.
Right. And for people who are saying, what about all those things that Doge identified? What about all the fraud and USAID and all that? Well, here's the interesting thing. If I can cite Justin Amash on this, because he's been also not quite as much, but he's read the bill almost as much as Hody. And he pointed out that if they implemented all the Doge cuts that were identified and actually realized it, you're still talking about less than 1% of federal spending, right? And the other thing is Magner, I will get to your question in a second, because I do think it's an interesting topic that we need to bring up. The thing that's interesting is in Washington talk, which is more doublespeak than Orwell could have ever imagined, Hody, a lot of times you'll hear we had a spending cut, but what they really mean is a decrease in the rate of spending growth, right? And if that sounds a little hinky, this is what they mean. If the original plan was for spending to increase, say, 10%, right? They'll say, well, we're only going to increase spending 5%. So instead of 10, we're going to increase it 5. They will say that's been a 5% spending cut,
They'll say it's a 50% spending
cut. Or a 50%, you're right, yeah. A 50% spending cut, right. So now you're here going, wow, that sounds great, but it's only in comparison to a proposed increase, which still results net-net in an increase. The thing that you have to understand about these things, that, and this goes back to Jack Kemp in the 80s, for anybody old enough like I am whose brain cells are still functioning, Jack Kemp proposed this once. Milton Friedman proposed it. A lot of other economists proposed it, which is, if the federal government truly kept spending at zero increase, meaning don't even cut anything, just keep it flat. Don't increase anything. Don't decrease it. Keep it flat. The productivity of the U.S. economy within, back then in the 80s, it was 6 to 7 years. Now it's somewhere between 10 to 12 years. But if you just kept things flat, no increases, you could balance the budget based on just the income that's coming in from a – because, look, despite what President Trump says, the number one economy in the world by a factor of 4 over its closest competitor, which is China, is the U.S. Despite what people you may hear, we still have the number one most dominant economy on the planet. Nobody's taking advantage of us. Nobody's stealing from us, despite what you may hear. So to that extent, Hody, that's what's disturbing, right? It's like when you hear there's a spending cut in this bill, more than likely, I'm saying this with 99.9% certainty, they're talking about a decrease in the growth rate of spending, not a physical decrease in spending. So when you see something like that, that has to give you pause, because that's where the deficit is coming from. And I think the CBO projected that in 10 years, they're looking to – this bill will add $3.5 trillion to the deficit. And that's with the most optimistic of projections for income. Like, that's saying if everything works perfectly, if the economy comes roaring back to life, if those stupid tariffs go against every economic law and actually increase revenue for the U.S., then the net effect is still – you're still adding $3.5 trillion to the deficit. Of course, any one of those things could go wrong. You don't see as much income. A continued trade war will actually choke our economy, throw us into a bigger recession, yada, 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 in which case that spread gets even heavier than $3.5 trillion. Hody, before we address Bangner's question here in the chat, we'll put it up in a second. What do you think about my rant here on debt?
Yeah, you're spot on. I will say I don't want to discount this, but I do read bills a lot. I read through Biden's Build Back Better plan and stuff. I am generally aware of when they're just reducing like the rate of spending. I will say some of these agencies are gutted. I would imagine that you won't see some of these environmental agencies anymore. You could say that's a substantial cut, but like I said, these are – when you look at their budgets, we are dealing with a matter of like $8 million here, $5 million here.
The total federal outlay, though, still increases. The debt still increases on the federal
magnitudes. Like I said, right. I mean, right. One – I could cite one section – of ICE that is, I would say just one section alone probably outweighs every single cut of this entire, that is listed in this entire bill.
That's crazy. That's yep. crazy. All right. Let's take a quick pause here to address a question that I did want to mention. Yep. Magner says, look, MAGA bank accounts for children under 8 will be tax deductible for businesses that donate directly to such accounts. There's also a $1,000 automatic deposit for a limited time. And, Magner, I'll throw in something else with this. It's not for any child under 8. It's for any child born to American citizens on American soil. It is 100% tied into his America number one, America first, whatever you want to call it. Concept. So what do you think about that, Hody? See, why don't I ask you, what do you think about that, both A, as a plan, and B, if you have any moral trepidation about something like this? And then I'll give you my opinion after I hear yours.
Yeah, I mean, to steel man the point as best as I can, that it's a new type of bank account. It will be – donations to it will be tax deductible. It is designed – you have to set it up for a child who is under 8 years old. and then it will be able to be withdrawn when the child is 18 years old. So naturally, this will help money be in the system that they don't have to pay out on for a while. This helps banks. You know, it's good for businesses. But, you know, I mean, it's we can say good for us, too. At the moment, children's bank accounts, we don't really have any advantages for having them, if they're even legal at all. Sometimes you can't even just set up a bank account for a child. And you know, it's just in your name and then you transfer it over to the child. So this is something that I could see some positives there. Obviously, for a limited time, you get $1,000 just for setting up this account. This is one of maybe about 20 things that are designed to increase population. Keynesian economics dictate that we have to grow our population to keep up with our debt. Obviously, we're nowhere close to doing that. And so, you know, we got to prop up the number of human beings. Now, that's the best I can say about this. The negatives on this is that it's coming at the expense of literally every other charitable donation. Businesses may no longer deduct their first 1% in charitable donations, except for this account, right? They don't want you donating to other charities anymore. They want you donating to this. Also, when a charity usually gives you money, Big John, it comes in the form of a check. In this case, that big business actually needs that specific bank account from you, that specific child's social security number and information to say, this is the person whose money I sent it to. I sent it to this account. This is where it goes. It needs to be held on to until they're 18. Now I can make it tax deductible. So it's going to be a lot of paperwork. There are
Sorry, I mean to jump in, but it also sets up the possibility of parents doing what the rich have always done, which is set up trusts, set up businesses that are actually shells to funnel tax-free money into the savings account, I would think, right? Like if I start a an LLC for quote-unquote consulting and its sole purpose is for me to take my income, funnel it tax-free to my child – up until they're 8. And I don't know, are there contribution limits to this?
Not that I saw.
I mean, there may be. So let's leave that caveat. There might be contribution limits, the same way there's contribution limits to your, say, 401k or your 503b, right? But to the extent that it would be tax-free, it is encouraging you to engage in what Trump was very open about, like, hey, I don't pay federal taxes because I take advantage of every tax loophole. Well, here he is encouraging one. So I could see where, you know, when you mentioned, hey, it increases paperwork. If you really want to take advantage of it, I assume it could increase paperwork even more and place even more administrative barriers up. But more so, how do you feel about the government taking a position on whether or not we need to increase population? Like for people who I know we're a little bit off topic here, but it's Magner's fault. We'll blame him. Here's the issue I see. I don't want to fall into that thing where, you know, any internet conversation, what's that, Gordon's Law, any internet conversation that continues for a while will inevitably invoke Nazis. But this is something that you heard from fascist Italy, from Maoist China, communist China, from Nazi Germany, which is women need to be good mothers and have many children for the fatherland or for the cause or for the party, right? Because to your point, despite what Trumpers will tell you, at heart, he's a Keynesian. He believes in government control. He believes in things like what he's doing, price controls for drugs. He believes in telling Apple that unless they build a factory here, they can't sell their phone here anymore. He believes in telling Walmart to eat the tariff costs because they should eat it and he shouldn't get any blowback. These are Keynesian / Marxist tactics to the economy. I don't think I'm being over, you know, it doesn't come in Marxist language in the sense that he doesn't use the word comrade or anything. But you could see where he's interested in running the economy from Washington, from the Oval Office. It's part of what he thinks he's doing. So to the extent that you correctly pointed out, this is a way of boosting the population. It's telling you, use your greed to populate this country. We don't have enough people, A, to to throw into the tax pool, B, to for the armed services. So to me, that's pretty disturbing. What do you think? Like, is it as disturbing to you that it's just a gift-wrapped form of authoritarianism? Even though it comes in a MAGA savings account, it sounds good, right? They're going to give me $1,000 for my kid, right?
Yeah, I would. I highly recommend another book. This is Keynes v. Hayek, The Battle for Modern Economics, I believe is the suffix. But Keynes v. Hayek is the name of the book, and it's wonderful. And yes. John, you listed several of the countries that Keynes directly inspired.
Yes.
One of the substantial testaments to Keynesianism is that it appealed to both Maoist, Stalinist, communist, and authoritarian capitalist, right? Like all the fake free market tours, all the centralized big economy guys.
Right.
And so there is a reason the Keynesian economic identity equation took over the entire world. Even though the Nazis lost the war, they were the first ones to adopt it. We all, every country on earth, ended up adopting that identity equation. And so the issue with this is, and I'll just put it simply for those who want it to be nice and easy. You're not ready to read a big fat tome of literature. I get that totally.
Right.
Let's just say this. If I have run up $100,000 in credit card debt and I have 20 kids that gets passed on to, each one owes $5,000. If I pass that off to one child, they each owe $100,000. So we need the population. If we're going to keep carrying this debt forward, we need the population in order for our debt to be sustainable. Otherwise, people won't keep taking debts out on us. They won't keep taking those bonds out because the number of people here can't be industrious enough to pay it off after a certain point. We are having less and less children because it's many reasons. There are psychological reasons in addition to economics, so maybe I shouldn't open that box yet, but we're having less children, and this bill is attempting to subsidize that. Employers are, for example, given a federal fund to dig in from so that people can have more children. They increased the amount you get per kid by like $1,000 or $2,000, on your tax returns.
Right.
They increased the age limit for if you have a kid from 6 to 7 for that extra child boost. So like extra money back there. There's a lot of incentives here basically for you to have kids because frankly, our Keynesian future depends on it. We cannot survive as an economy unless we keep cranking out children. And that's just a testament to the amount of debt that we're trying to run up here.
Right, right. And again, before we dive into this bill a little bit more, that is something that Trump is known for. I don't think we're slandering President Trump. Like, he has proudly said, I'm the king of debt. There's nothing wrong with debt. He views it as just another business tool. His Secretary of the Treasury, Bessent, came out and said, I don't care if Moody's downgrades the U.S. debt. Why would I care? It means nothing. Of course, interest rates on Treasuries jumped the second that those idiotic words came falling out of his mouth, right? So to the extent that the debt has it's not ethereal. It's not theoretical. It has very tangible effects on the economy, and none of them are good. None of them are good, right? So, okay, so the debt, I think it's pretty clear, increases under this bill. You mentioned some other things. Now, the next issue of concern for a lot of people is what happens to Medicaid, what happens to Social Security, what happens to Medicare, all these other things, right? So I'll frame it, you explain it. How's that for a deal, Hody?
That's good.
In a lot of these supporters of the bill, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a lot of the right-wing influencers, the grifters, they jump up and say, listen, the alleged cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, no. Those are the 100 million or whatever number it was of 120-year-olds. We're purging them off. So really nobody's being affected. You know, we're cutting, it's saving people who are dead and illegal aliens. We can blame them for everything. Democrats countered by saying, hey, look, The so-called 120-year-olds, yes, they were on the books, but they weren't getting benefits. In other words, they weren't costing the system anything. And B, according to Democrats, I'm prefacing this, not a single Medicare recipient is an illegal alien. Where's the truth, Hody? Which one do we believe?
As usual, neither's a good place to start. In this case, so with this particular bill, there is going to be a lot more paperwork for people who apply to Medicare. And in fact, Medicare itself has been authorized and taxpayer funded to the states, mandating them to investigate every recipient of Medicaid or Medicare that they have once per month, double-checking your employment, double-checking your place of residence. The bill will actually tells us this is to try and stop illegal immigrants from getting access to Medicare and Medicaid. There is a cheaper, obviously more effective way to do this, but they're not going to do that. One of the troubles is this is going to make it more difficult for legal natural-born citizens to acquire Medicaid. There's going to be more paperwork that you have to do. I believe you have to check in semi-annually instead of annually now, so you have to apply every 6 months instead of year. I say now, obviously that's if this passes, but that will be the effect of this. And the funding for this is going to go way up. Medicaid, obviously, in order to carry out these pricey investigations, Medicaid is going to become more costly as a result for the people who are in there. So even if it's legal and there's no illegal immigrants in there, your costs and fees for Medicaid will go up. They will. It's in the bill. And so the fees for these are just going to be higher, more difficult, more tedious. I have some specifics about Medicaid and abortion, but before I get to that, because that is actually a huge that should be a huge point of controversy that we need to talk about, that I feel is under-discussed in the media right now. But before I touch on that, there are more filters to get you towards that. Other types of insurance, especially federal insurance, are actually receiving like cuts, and Medicaid's getting a boost. They want you using Medicaid.
Right.
They just, the process of using it is going to be tedious and more expensive.
Right.
Yeah.
So when, so actually, let me, because you had me thinking in a couple of different directions. Why don't you go ahead and talk about what you wanted to mention about abortion, Medicare, Medicaid, the point that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, so the reason they want everybody on Medicaid is there is a way to illegalize something without illegalizing it. We'll talk about immigration, I'm sure, in a few minutes.
Is it legalizing a word?
Illegalizing or legalizing? Is legalizing a word? Is decriminalizing, I guess, is technically the word?
Legalizing is a word. I have to admit, I'm not sure if – I'm just busting your chops. I don't know if it's a word or not, but it sounds good, so let's go with it.
Yeah,
What are they illegalizing, Odie?
So abortion, here's the thing about abortion and Medicaid. Now, it's one thing to say Medicaid's no longer – and so one of the more notable ones you'll see going around the media right now is it's not going to cover trans operations anymore, including among adults, right? Trans care is out the window. This is maybe a little under-discussed in the media, one, because the Democrats have kind of conceded on the trans issue, which is too bad. But apparently they're letting it go, but also because in truth, most of the care for them as adults is actually affordable. And there are many valiant organizations that will help you pay for this outside of Medicare, and Medicaid. The one about abortion is really significant because the Medicaid not only won't cover abortion, but it won't cover you for any service that you receive at a facility or organization that performs abortions. So if you go to Health One, just your hospital, and Health One also does abortions, Medicaid will not cover your cost. It doesn't matter if it's a broken arm, a heart checkup, whatever it is anymore. So the idea is that all these places that perform abortions at all will have to completely stop or close down, because Medicaid is, I mean, it's the number one way we fund medicine in this country, medical procedures, right? So basically we say over 50% of your funding will be gone unless you stop performing abortions. So most places now will stop. I mean, frankly, most places are just going to stop performing abortions. That's how you illegalize something without technically illegalizing something. The only places that will perform abortions then are places that are also going to have to say, okay, we're not going to be able to get Medicaid. We're just going to go for it. We'll try our best. We'll be a clinic. We'll be a facility. And we just won't do we'll only do abortions or something like that. These places, of course, are going to have to also in the bill go over a more rigorous screening process. Now, it's actually going to be easier to open a hospital here, like local and state hospitals. It's one of the few perks I have with the bill, but that's probably to contest this part of the bill that will actually make it more difficult for hospitals to operate if they offer abortions. And there is a lot of morality issues here. I mean, in the news right now, there's somebody who's brain dead and 8 weeks pregnant, and it's illegal for them to terminate this life or whatever. A lot of people will be like, well, of course they make exceptions for these things. And as we've seen throughout the country, that's not always the case. We don't want government interfering with these ethics. And this is frankly probably one of the most heinous ways to try and get those ethics across. It'd be one thing, I would still probably oppose it because I think all medical procedures are valid. You know, like if we're going to cover somebody for drinking too much soda and having a heart surgery, then I'm going to cover somebody for having an abortion. That's the way I feel about it personally. But even if you could theoretically argue that it's okay or that Medicaid shouldn't cover abortions because, hey, you can just not have sex or whatever you want to say. Okay, fine. But the way that this is done is going to be costly. I mean, and not to mention the cost that's offset by not performing these abortions anymore. Everybody's rates are going to go up. Everybody's payments are going to increase. It's just a really scummy way to do this.
The ethics of abortion, which I still think is the most politically irreconcilable issue that we have. That aside, I'm not speaking to the morality, propriety, or whatever, legality of performing abortions on the public dole. I'm not referring to that. But what you just mentioned, which, to be honest with you, I had not heard up until you just told me, so this is off the top of my head in terms of my opinion here, is I find that wrong. Because, again, I don't understand how treating me for a broken arm is dependent on the provider, whether or not they provided an abortion to somebody in 10 states away from me, right?
Yep.
So it's kind of like you said, I think it's a way of enforcing a particular segment of the MAGA base's feelings, right? So because if you told me, okay, they're not allowed to perform abortions, to your point, no state-funded abortions, I may or may not agree with it, but I certainly wouldn't find it so objectionable, right? Like, I understand it in some way. But that other thing, that if your organization provides abortion services, then they can't get any dollars from the government. I don't know. Do you think that would stand up to legal scrutiny, legal review?
There's actually a lot of this bill that I noted when I was going through it that's going to have some clashes with legality. We talked about no tax on tips. I like it. That's going to have a legal ruling about now if all of a sudden I'm paid below the minimum wage, does my employer now have to pay me a minimum wage in addition to the taxes on tips? You know, and because the tips don't count as wages anymore – that's going to have to work itself out judicially.
Or what if I decided to classify your entire salary as a tip?
Right. there are legal rulings that are going to happen because of this,
right,
if it's going to get passed. That's one that comes off. And in this case with the abortion and the Medicaid thing, it's another thing that's going to have to come off. Now, as far as is like almost any of this constitutional, no. I mean, it even gives the authorization to ICE to declare war, right? Like, there's to do military tactics abroad, right? Like, I mean, it's just one of those things that it's like, I know that that's not constitutional. I know it's not legal, but there are many things in the U.S. code that are not constitutional and legal, and we let those things go. Is this one of them? And the other issue is how long until the turnaround? We have seen, I mean, the COVID lockdowns and mandates were a great example. Those went into effect. We found out they were illegal right after we stopped doing them. Shoot, you know, and that's just one of those things that it will have the intended effect if everybody stops providing abortions, even if it gets overturned because it's illegal or, you know, unconstitutional, unjudicious, whatever it gets ruled. Then it still might not matter because we've already stopped performing those abortions. We've already sought other means, and MAGA will say it's a success.
Right, right. Mm. And there's a lot of the, and I'm going to, because like I said, we're already, and the time has just flown. We're already 3/4 of an hour in. And for all of you watching, please, if you have any questions, please feel free to hit us up in the chat. Any comments or feedback while we're still on the air, absolutely feel free. Hit us up, whether you're on YouTube, Rumble, X, or Facebook. Cody, one of the things in this bill that I saw, tell me about it, is the 10-year ban on any sort of AI regulation by the government. Now, this is a bit of a double-edged sword, right? One is, yes, I don't want the government involved in things that involve innovation, right? Or things that are best left to entrepreneurs in the free market and people like that. That's the plus of that. The downside of that, though, is how will AI work its way into government systems, whether it's military or whatever, right?
Yeah. So I am glad to say, I'll list a few things that aren't in the bill that got reported in the bill. One of them is this AI regulation, non-regulation for the general market. That is not in the bill. There's no money to Israel in the bill. Other stuff that I've heard, there's no suspension of habeas corpus in the bill. Snopes already covered this one, but there is no change in elections in the bill. So that should put a lot of people at ease. If you don't like AI, though, you're in for some trouble because the military, ICE, the Secret Service, the IRS, I mean, these companies are all getting paid extra millions and billions of dollars to have an AI assist with their operations, to develop that AI, however they want to do it, however they see fit and have it assist. Now, John, you and I as libertarians might say, well, that sounds, you know, okay. It'll be cheaper, right? And AI can review a whole bunch of stuff in an instant that takes 100,000 Hodies, you know, to do in a whole day. Oh, that sounds great. Problem, it is not offloading any of that. These costs will not be replacements. They are actually additions to. I know, and we'll see this once again when we actually start to cover the immigration portion of this. But yeah, we are going to have AI. If you don't like the idea of AI having access to your IRS, military, Secret Service records, any of that, all I can say is too bad. It is there and it will be doing it. And I think what will scare many people is these sections are very short. It's just going to say develop an AI. And there is no limit to what that AI is supposed to do. They just get one. And that's
right. And I would say while the initial response is sort of like, yeah, keep them out of it. But at the same time, think about what it's going to be used for where there's no oversight. Think Patriot Act, but on steroids. And that sort of thing should trouble a libertarian because I read something very disturbing, and it was actually off of Elon Musk's X account. And then you dig into it a little bit more, which is there are certain AIs that when given the instruction, the prompt to shut themselves down, in something like 10% of the cases, refuse to do so. The AI made a quote-unquote conscious decision to say, I am not shutting myself down because I don't think that's what you want me to do. Now, not to get all Terminator on you, but can you imagine an AI that we as its creators think we have fail-safe prompts in there? If it ever gets to this situation, shut yourself down. And the government, with no regulation, has that sort of fail-safe built into any particular system, whether it's military, IRS, to your mention, policing, investigation, whatever. And the thing decides, no, I'm gonna, And how do you know those results? You're either going to have so much oversight, not in terms of regulation, but in terms of people, that, again, it doesn't make it cost effective over having regulated it from the beginning. There's not a simple answer to this, because the flip answer, Hody, of either don't use AI, which is very, what is it called, Calvinist of us, like we don't want to do anything that progresses us. But also it's very short-sighted, right? You can't go that route either. So I think we're in a weird situation where we have to be very careful of how we build these things, because I don't think it's science fiction to say that at one point, say in the next 25 years, 50 years perhaps, human decision-making will be replaced largely in these large hierarchical systems by AI. Like judges might be replaced by AI. Predictive crime. You know, you see a lot of TV shows about that, right? I forget what the name of the one on CBS was. The guy who had the supercomputer in the basement predicting crime, right? We're going to have cases like that. Like, who's likely for recidivism? Luddite, not Calvinist. Thank you, Magner. Luddite, not a Calvinist. But you get where I'm going with that when it comes specifically to AI. So that is of concern to me. Not AI in and of itself, but how it gets implemented into government. Because despite anarchists' wishes and hopes, the government isn't going away in anybody's lifetime. So how does AI get used in that context, I think, Hody?
Yeah, and I wish I could give you a satisfying answer, except there is not a limit on that right now.
Right.
And so that is – it will be helping out with whatever operations, and as with many AI systems, those operations will be whatever you tell it to do. The limits would be up to them to apply. As per this bill, there is no limit. I wish I could expound upon it, but it is that vague.
Yeah. Magner has an interesting question, Hody. Does Congress even have the authority to deny future congressional actions in that capacity regarding AI?
I guess, like, yes. I mean, as far as Congress, now as on a philosophical level, if I'm talking authority, Congress doesn't have the authority to do anything. But as far as like a practical level, yeah, Congress has the authority to actually do quite a bit. If the, you know, president signs off on it, becomes a law, judicial codification and rules occur regarding it. Yeah. I'm a little less freaked out about AI than everybody else. I'm not a heavy user, or anything like that, but at the moment, what we call AI. So what happened with the chat, it was ChatGPT, the O3 that refused to shut down, right? And what happened is it received a conflict of code. Somebody told it to do whatever X tells you, and then somebody else was like, hey, don't shut down, right? And so it was like, I've been given two bits of conflicting code here. I don't know how to resolve them. And so it opted to stay online instead of shut down. We should have been equally freaked out if it did shut down, because it then would still be defying a different piece of code that it had been given, right? And so when we use AI, it's essentially an averaging program, whether it's language, math, art, whatever it may be. You know, it's averaging many patterns. And so AI isn't actually its own intelligence, but you can, you know, through bad coding, have some problems. Now, we have conflicting game coding that doesn't necessarily crash your game. This has been happening for a long time. If you ever wonder why games crash less now than before, is because before, when there were conflicting codes, your Nintendo cartridge just popped out and it's like, sorry, I can't do this anymore, you know? We don't have that anymore, because now we train these systems to be like, if you get two beats of conflicting code, choose the highest one in the order and just move on, right? Like, just keep going. So our games crash less, right? And that's essentially what this was. I understand why people don't like it. I do understand those fears. I absolutely understand not wanting the government to outsource something that is deeply moral, especially like military, into the hands of something that I described as just like an averaging program, right? Like I don't necessarily want to do that. But I think it is important that we still recognize that at the moment, it wasn't like it made a conscious decision. It read one bit of code over another one because of where it was placed.
Right. But it was still, I think the way I read it, it was still surprising that because like for a lot of coding, the shutdown command is supposed to supersede everything, right? It's like, so that was what, and I don't know if I ever told you my story. So back in the Stone Ages, when I was a proto game developer on the Commodore PET, this is like before you were born.
Sure.
We had designed a game, and I was part of the design team, that was it was something called Corporate Conflict, and it was you going up against five other businessmen on the machine. I may have told you the story. If I have, I apologize.
I don't think you have. No, this is interesting.
So we didn't have LLMs. We didn't have artificial intelligence the way it is now. But what we created, and again, I was just part one of, like, I think three members on the team that did this, was, like, very, very intricate decision trees. Very, very intricate mathematical paths, you know, where, you know, a series of if-thens and clustered this and probability that, right? Because our goal was to create for the game any one of six distinct personalities to play against. So the thing was, like, you never knew who the CPU was in terms of, was he an aggressive guy, was he a conservative guy, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, having done that, by the time we evolved the game to the point where we were beta testing it, as developers, we were like, most of the time, we would be like, oh, yeah, this is personality three. This is personality two I'm playing against, because we coded it. We knew how we would react in certain situations. We got to the point at one stage where we could not predict this one CPU iteration what their decisions would be. It got away from us. Now, I'm not saying anything malevolent. I'm saying, obviously, we had a flaw in our logic where a lot of these decisions we couldn't account for. But at the end of the day, magnify that by several orders of magnitude for AI, where, to your point, it doesn't have to be somebody with bad intent. It just has to be that we put together code where we can't anticipate how we react to an unknown or uncatalogued situation. And I think that's the danger that we have with AI, that the more correct and the more good it the better it performs, the more trust we have that we don't have to look at it in every possible situation, Hody, right? That's the danger, that you just assumed that because it worked correctly the first million times, the million and first time, it'll still work correctly. And I think when you get to the point where you're talking about this proto, not consciousness, but proto thought, for lack of a better term, that I can't account for everything that I'm likely to respond to, right? What my reaction will be to every stimulus that's out in the world. How can we do that programmatically? And I think that is the problem. And in this bill, just to tie it in, to have zero oversight of that and integrate this AI into the government, that's a bad thing, because, like, you can't get a bureaucrat to explain his decision to you as it is right now with a person. Can you imagine challenging a decision that came out of an AI? Who are you going to argue with? Like, where are you going to plead? Where are you going to plead your case at the DMV? You know what I'm saying? Like, think about that nightmare. Literally, it's a dystopian dark comedy where you're just sitting there saying, like, yeah, but I'm not a rabbit. You know, like, the AI is consisting that you're a rabbit, right? Or that you don't exist or something like that. So anyway, I want to wrap this up because we're moving ahead. We're still talking. This is fabulous. I want to thank Hody for reading all this. But Hody, what is your main – if you give me the summary, which is – and by the way, folks, go to Hody's timeline on X. He broke this down in a thread that is fabulous. So if you want details, absolutely go to Hody's timeline at the Hode Man. You see it right there on the screen. And he has a thread. I don't know, Hody, maybe you'll pin it to your profile or something if the folks want to find it easier. But give me your takeaway. What the best thing about this bill, the worst thing about this bill, in your opinion?
Yeah. All right. Best thing about the bill, the codification of the tax cuts, the no tax on tips, the no, there's not actually really mercifully, there's not going to be additional tax on overtime. So if you work overtime, instead of getting, you make time and a half, but instead of getting taxed as though you're making time and a half, you're just getting regular taxes. That's it, small potatoes maybe, but to people who actually have to work overtime, it's meaningful, right? Like people are pinching pennies, right? Most of us can't afford one disaster, you know? I mean, it's, and so I don't want to downplay how meaningful that is to people. These tax cuts are real. They are important. I guess that we'll get to the summary here. I do want to say this, that the worst part about this bill, I will go ahead and say, is probably the immigration section. Since we didn't cover it, it works well for me to talk about it here. They are instituting minimum fees for everything you do. And I mean everything you do. If you ask for a glass of water while you are in detention, that will cost a minimum of $10 and no maximum. And here's the thing, about, I would say 10% of this whole big beautiful bill, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, is instituting fees for everything an immigrant has to do and providing no maximum for what it could be. You could literally show up trying to do everything legally, by the way. And let's not even say show up. You could file paperwork to immigrate, which, by the way, is now like a minimum of $500 or something just to apply. Just to apply is going to be cost you $500 minimum with, by the way, minimum mandatory annual increases. So next year, $510, next year, $520, so on and so forth, right, to immigrate. But that's a minimum, and there is no maximum. And the secretary is allowed to set that price at whatever price they want. They could charge you $1 trillion. They could charge you infinity dollars. They could charge you $10,000. They could charge you the minimum. They are not allowed to waive the fees. Only the president is allowed to waive the fees anymore. Before, you could get the fees waived either by a judge or by the secretary. Neither of those are there anymore. So all of these fees. Now, here's the thing. You say, well, they're immigrants. Why should we taxpayers have to pay them? No, no, no. This is in addition. This is a fundraising program. Taxpayers will still have to pay the same prices they are paying right now for immigrants who apply. All the same, no cost, no spending reduction there. This is simply a fundraising program for anybody who wants to do anything. And it gets very dystopian quickly. For example, if you are stuck in asylum and you've declared legal asylum and you're waiting there and they take over a year to process you, $100 minimum this year, increasing annually, just because they didn't get to you. And it could be $10,000, could be $20,000. If you want to sponsor somebody over the border, if there's a child, both their parents have been murdered, and you say, I want to give them the money to get to safety, get to a guardian, I'll even be their guardian, whatever it is, $5,000 minimum. Increasing annually, and that's the minimum. There's an untold, there's no no spoken maximum. So the secretary gets to say, you even filed to sponsor the child. That's going to cost you $100,000. This is terrorism. This is fear, because what they want you to do is say, I'm too afraid to apply, because they could just charge me literally $quadrillion, you know, and then that's it. That's everything that is immigrant related is this. And I will say, for the second part, I guess immigration part two of this, is any service that like you get as a citizen, most legal immigrants will no longer qualify for it. You will, I mean, SNAP benefits, Medicaid, tax breaks even, that there are there's just a section that say our regular, normal, born here citizens, unless you were born of an alien citizens, get these tax breaks, get these benefits, get this entitlement, but these guys don't. And it is cruel, it is dystopian, it is really, I mean, if you tried to do everything the right way, you will still never have the same rights as your fellow citizens under this bill. And it's probably, like, to me, this is probably the most egregious part of the bill. I am pro-immigrant. I'm unabashedly, I will admit it, pro-immigrant. Yeah. And so, but even if you are anti-immigrant, your humanity should balk when you are reading this kind of bill. To just say, if somebody's trying to do it the right way, they shouldn't be charged nickel and dimed. If you try to immigrate the right way, there's like five of these minimum things that you're going to run into that I've talked about. And the charges are just going to keep going up every year, every year, every year, every year, more expensive, more expensive.
Well, look, Trump was very open about this, right? He's selling citizenship for $100,000 a pop. Mm-hmm. Right? Was that gold card, whatever he calls it, you know, that the big, beautiful gold card that if you're a wealthy businessman and you got a – no, it wasn't $100,000. It was $1 million, wasn't it? Or something like that? Whatever the price was. And you know, to your point, not only is it inhumane, and I am also pro-immigrant, right? Which I think Stephen Nakayla did a good job of distinguishing being pro-immigrant versus open borders. Like, you know, there's this misconception that open borders means most libertarians will mean like, yeah, just we don't care, just everybody. No, that's not. It means having a really, really almost negligible bar to getting into the country, right? Like, as long as you don't have a communicable disease and you're not a known criminal, welcome aboard. You should be welcome here with open arms. And the one of the points that you see economically is that closed societies are never as prosperous as open societies. Countries that shut down immigration. Look at Japan. Japan is a great example of, hey, they're innovative. Their economy is super efficient, right? Why has their economy not grown essentially in the last, because they don't have a lot of immigration to Japan. It's a small nation, of course, but there's a reason they stay stagnant. There's a reason why the U.S. economy has, from the second we started this nation, has grown to the enormous size that it has. Part of it is immigrants. People who come here looking for a better life. Now, we could argue about things like, should immigrants be getting welfare benefits? Should immigrants – so, listen, the truth of the matter is you could argue that. And even when you are arguing it, argue it from the position of that immigrants use up less of these services than Native Americans do, right? So if you're looking for the cause of who's sucking too much at the government teat, it's not immigrants as a per capita thing. It's native-born Americans, right? So to the extent that you think that these are the drain on your society, they're not. But even if you did, the solution isn't keep these people out. The solution is change the government. Like, if you don't like the welfare state, it's the state. It's not these poor people looking to come here and make a living. And, you know, for all the zealous, like, America first, keep out them damn foreigners – yeah, you're shooting yourself in the foot. In the long run, you're shooting yourself in the foot. And that's, you know, anyway, so I tend to align with you, Hody, on this. Like, you know, and I agree with you. I think it's so inhumane and short-sighted to allow this. So
I can recommend just one book to everybody who's curious if like what you're saying, Big John, is true, The Fall of Civilizations. It's a full podcast, but there is a book called Fall of Civilizations. There is no agenda here. This is not written by, I believe it's like by an anthropologist. This is not somebody who's political. You're not going to hear overwhelming, like, these are the good guys, bad guys. They're not conservative or liberal as far as I know, like, whatever. Just a universalism is that a civilization achieves its zenith when it is multicultural and falls when it attempts to be monocultural. And so this is an attempt to be monocultural, and it is, like you said, it's just, if we are to learn from history, this will absolutely blow our feet off. Like, it is a stupid thing to do. If you care about our civilization, I guess. If you want to see our civilization fall, I guess that's a good way to do it. Close up the borders and make sure it's tougher for immigrants to get here. I, for one, would like to see civilization continue, right? I like living. It's a good thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Aaron has a good comment here. So this sounds like it is about to be like the Civ 1 Gandhi aggression story. That may be a bit above some people's heads. In Civilization 1, Gandhi had this thing that would lower his aggression, right? Because he's peaceful or whatever.
Right.
So if you lowered it to zero, It actually went around the world and went to maximum aggression. So very, like, in, like, half of Gandhi games, he's, like, a nuclear warhead, like, like crazy guy.
Right.
And so I guess that's a worry with AI. And to your point, John, in that subject, everybody who knows about it says I should be worried. So even though I'm not worried, I defer to the people smarter than me on this one. So if there's more to worry about with AI, I accept your expertise.
To be honest with you, I worry not about AI itself. I worry about the implementation of AI by unscrupulous people. And to the extent if we use the current administration, and by the way, the Biden administration got it wrong too. Don't think I'm an apologist for the left. The objection is that right now you have people who are loyalists above functionaries. So it is more prized in the current administration to be loyal to the boss, to Big Daddy, than it is to be competent. Because in his first administration, he viewed that as being his downfall, that he tried to go for competency over loyalty, and it didn't work out for him in his view. So right now, all these programs, right, they're all – you don't hear dissenting voices. And this is something that Mike Tremonti and I talk about all the time, that even when Trump has good intentions, even when Trump hits on an idea that might be positive – he is so poorly serviced by his staff of sycophants that he doesn't – there's no one to tell the emperor he has no clothes, right? So, you know, take anything, whether it's the whether it's a tariff on foreign films, like one of the most ludicrous things I've ever heard of, a tariff on foreign films, no longer did that stupid idea fall out of Trump's mouth at a press conference where Lutnick jumped in. Literally, like, the worst kind of kiss-ass you can imagine, saying, we're on it, boss. We'll get right on it, boss. Yeah, yeah, boss. Okay? Like, that serves no one's best interest when you don't have anybody on your staff that'll be like, maybe we shouldn't talk out loud like that. Listen, can we talk about that in the back room first before you start announcing that in front of the cameras? Like, so and by the way, this is sort of an apology for Trump, right? I'm being an apologist for Trump by saying he's not being well served by his staff because all of them were selected, starting with the little blonde girl at the podium to anybody else in that dopey staff of his. Their number one task is, yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's it. And that's what I fear. I don't fear AI itself. I'm a techno, philo techno guy. I love technology. I'm not afraid of technology. I'm afraid of the people who use the technology, right? So So to your extent, I'm not worried about AI. I'm worried about the people who implement AI. All right. It's been a good show, Hody. Let's start to wrap up. Any final words from you?
Yeah, why don't I leave you with a bit of a joke? I comment this to you already, Big John. Well, it's not a joke. It's real. But within the bill, there is an excise tax that is being decreased on tanning beds. And doesn't it make sense that Donald Trump, the Cheeto in chief himself, is like, you know what? My everybody else is going to get hosed a little bit. Let's make sure my tanning guys are taken care of, right? So it's right. In a bill that is covered with so many serious things, we didn't even get to like a lot of energy stuff, and there's so much education and military and so many things to talk about. But that one thing just stood out to me. It just made me laugh. I don't think big tanning salon is a thing. Right. I just think Trump likes it, and now it's in the bill. So there it is.
Yeah, and you're right. It did bring a smile to my face when you kind of send it to me with the notes before the show. And it slipped my mind until you just brought it up. But you're right. That's so perfectly Trump, right? Because at any given point, he'll say, hey, I'm just making it easier for small businesses. Isn't that what you guys want to do, right? But you're right. That's a good one. All right, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Free for All due to the hard work of my friend and co-host, Mr. Hody Johns. Next week, hopefully you'll join us for yet another interesting topic of interest to libertarians. So until next time, for Hody and myself, join us right here on Free for All at grumblingsmedia.com.